So Mark chapter 10 and verses 32 to 52. They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. "We are going up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, which means son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately, he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. Amen. What story are you in? That's the question for this morning. It's a bit of an odd question. What story are you in? Now, you might be thinking this morning, "Oh, Jeff, I'm tired. I haven't got the energy for this metaphysical stuff. Just take me through the passage verse by verse and I'll go home happy." But stick with me, because I think this is well worth it. It's a key to unlock some of the treasures in this passage. What story are you in? Because you see, we all live in a story. It's not always there present to our consciousness, but it shows up in how we act. And it might be rather different to what we think we believe. What story are you in? One way you can tell, someone suggested this test, is when you're on a long journey in a car right by yourself and there's nothing good on the radio, or you're on a train journey or a bus journey and your brain just sort of clicks into neutral. What do you daydream about? What do you think about? What's the picture that comes to mind that you kind of dwell on and just sort of sit there in? Another way we can tell what story we're in is what happens when we get stressed. What is it that makes us stressed? And then how do we react when we're under stress? Or thinking about the future, what is it that most worries us about the future? What is it that we're most excited about the future? What is it that fills our thoughts about the future? And also prayer. What do we most naturally want to pray about? What do we come to God to pray about? And we'll see more about that in this passage. What's our natural response to these sorts of things? Here's some examples of a story that that you might be in, or that one might be in. One is this: civilization and humanity is progressing. Everything is getting better. In my own life, things are getting better. I only have to stick around, and any little blips that happen, they'll be ironed out in the general upward progress. It's all getting better. If that's the story that you live in, then your future dreams will be about, you know, the way things will be when they get better. The things that stress you out will be when things don't seem to be getting better. because it's in contrast to the story that you're in. Another one might be, life is ultimately meaningless. You know, there's when we're all going to die, and when we die, that's it, gone, nothing left. Some stuff might last, we might have a legacy of a business we've built, or a book we've written, or a family that love us. But after that, you know, ultimately, the universe is going to implode or freeze or something. The sun's going to burn up the earth, and all of humanity will be wiped out, and everything will be utterly meaningless. And that's a story that many people live in, and that shows in when things really come to the crunch, because there is nothing absolute, there is no real meaning. Another one might be, I am a victim. The world conspires against me, and however hard I try, I cannot make things better. I cannot change things. I will always be the victim. And one final one, it might be, when I have achieved X, all will be well. When my bank balance has this number of zeros at the end of it, then you know every tear will be wiped from every eye and everything will come good. And that's the story that I live in and what makes my decisions for me. So maybe you're thinking, okay, yeah, I get that. There's a story, and maybe there's it's kind of like a meta-narrative that is there in everyone's life. And you might be thinking, well, my story is the gospel story. And it's really crucial that we realize that Christianity is a story. Christianity is a story. It's a true story, before you start whipping out the pitchforks, but it is a story. It's the story. It's the only true story with a capital T. It's the lens that brings everything else in all of our understanding and all of the world's existence into focus. It's the story into which every other story and every other religion and all of the difficulties of life fit. They fit into the Christian story. It's a story that works, that makes sense. It's absolutely true. It's actually the main reason why I'm a Christian, is that this story works. Which isn't to say that I'm completely pragmatic about it. I think it's true. It's that I believe it, heart and soul. But it's because it works. If it didn't work, I would be in serious doubt about how true it is, no matter how much evidence you showed me. But it absolutely does work. This thought, this whole idea, is most wonderfully expressed and explored by C.S. Lewis. He's the master at explaining all of these kinds of things. If you haven't read the Narnia Chronicles recently or ever, then I envy you, because you've got a treasure trove to dive back into. Even if you don't normally read stories, every Christian, I think personally, should be reading the Narnia stories on a regular basis, because they give us a key to force us to use our imagination to explore the story that we believe, the gospel story. And without our imaginations, we're not going to understand what Jesus came to teach. He used stories, he enacted a story, as we'll explore this morning. So we need to be able to get into stories. So read the Narnia stories, as, you know, and then go back to the Bible and let it see that the new kind of light and facets of the Bible that it unlocks. A famous quote from C.S. Lewis was, he said, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else." For him, this big story was like the sun coming up on a dark landscape. There's nothing to see, and then the sun comes up, you get this story lighting up the picture, and not only do you kind of see the light, but all of a sudden the whole landscape is lit up, and this big story makes sense of everything else. I want to share with you this painting. I don't know if you've seen it before. It hangs in a church called Christ Community Church in Franklin, Tennessee. It's a painting by a amazing fine art painter called David Arms. He's famous for painting birds, and he's a Christian. And this painting was commissioned by Pastor Scotty Smith, who was at the time the pastor of this church. And I came across it and was utterly blown away. I've got a copy of this in the front of my Bible. This is a picture, and you can't really see it very well in this light, unfortunately, but you can look it up, God's Story by David Arms. It's a picture of the big story. So here's a visual. I'll leave it up for the rest of this talk. It's a visual of this big story. There's all sorts of imagery here, which would take a whole kind of sermon to go through, but I'll just read you a little summary of it by Scotty Smith. God's story comes to us as a redemptive drama in four parts. Creation, the first panel, when everything was as God made it, meant it to be. Fall, the tragic intrusion of sin and death, resulting in the pervasive brokenness of all people and everything God has made. Then the third panel, redemption, God's astonishing promise to redeem his fallen image bearers and creation through the graceful work of his Son, Jesus Christ. And then the last panel, consummation, the magnificent fulfillment of God's plan to gather and cherish a people forever and to live with them in a more than restored world called the new heaven and new earth. Each panel of the painting presents one of the four interrelated parts of God's story, and each is replete with well-chosen symbols. First, you notice that a tree is the predominant image in each panel. Each tree is tagged with an identifying word: life, loss, love, and again, life. And then there's all the imagery and the birds, the specific birds that he's painted, and the fruit and the other objects in there. Come and talk to me about it afterwards if you want to know more about it, or there's a whole essay online about it. This is the big story: creation, fall, redemption, and consummation. And central to it, in the third panel, is the white cross in the middle of that tree. That is the central point in this big story, is Jesus dying on the cross. And so as we go into our passage this morning, this is what Jesus is talking about. He's predicting his death on the cross, and he's predicting it for the third time, maybe more than the third time. It's the third time it's specifically mentioned in Mark, but there's suggestion that he's talked about it with them a lot. Jesus is saying, my story, the big story, is going to center on me dying on a cross in Jerusalem, where we're currently heading at top speed. And Jesus is leading the way. I mean, just as a side point, who leads the way confidently striding towards their own death? Jesus' bravery and commitment is breathtaking. No wonder the disciples were astonished and those who followed were afraid. He's heading to where he has confidently been telling them he's going to be tortured and killed. But so Jesus is firmly in his story. He has absolute certainty about where he is going and what he is doing. But his disciples are in their own stories. They are in a story of their own, various ones perhaps, and they're not fully into his story that he is beckoning them into. They don't really get it. And that's a challenge to us, because if they don't really get what Jesus is doing when he's right there repeating it to them face to face and they're living with him 24/7, how much harder is it for us to get it, really get it, when we, you know, at best maybe connect with God periodically throughout the day, maybe even less than that. So let's see what they do and what we can learn from this and how it can help us. James and John, first of all, they are my favorite disciples. I think everyone's allowed a favorite disciple. I don't think some of them we know hardly anything about, but a lot of people's favorite disciple is Peter, because he gets stuff wrong all the time, and that's quite comforting. But mine is James and John. They also get stuff wrong all the time. Jesus gave them a nickname. They were called the Boanerges, the Sons of Thunder. You can see that in chapter 3, verse 17. There's a wonderful moment in the Miracle Maker film, which is a fantastic portrayal of the life of Jesus, stop-motion animation written by Murray Watts. And when the moment where Jesus is gathering his disciples and he's kind of clapping them on the shoulder and saying, Peter, you are the rock. James and John, the Sons of Thunder. And there's a kind of a chuckle around the group of disciples, like, yep, that's them. Possibly they're called the Sons of Thunder because they just dive in. They just make a big, loud thunderclap of whatever they're going to say. They just dive in with both feet and say it. They've done that already. Luke chapter 9, there's an incident where Jesus sends some disciples ahead to a village in Samaria to say, prepare for us, we're coming. The whole retinue is going to arrive. And they say, no, we don't want you here. Go away. And James and John are so offended by this that they say to Jesus, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to destroy them? And you can almost see Jesus going, oh, goodness. Sons of Thunder, here we go again. And he has to explain to them, no, that's not how I roll. So here they are, James and John, the Sons of Thunder, coming to Jesus with a request in typical Sons of Thunder fashion. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What's commendable about this is they really believe he can do it. Just as they believed he could call down fire from heaven to destroy a village if he wanted to, which he could, they believe he can do for them whatever they ask. That's awesome, and that's partly why I love them. They're just all out there, sold out for Jesus, just a little bit off the rails. But maybe that's the best way to be, utter commitment. And Jesus seems to love it. They come to him with this prayer, which is what this is, because they're talking to him. We're seeing two prayers here, James and John and then Bartimaeus, asking Jesus for things. And they they start off incredibly self-centered with this, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. But Jesus' reaction is fantastic. Because, you know, verse 36 could have read, and then Jesus turned to them and said, no, James and John, you've forgotten the lesson we had last week. It's ACTS, remember, acts, application, adoration, confession, thanksgiving, and then supplication. I haven't been adored, you haven't confessed anything, you certainly haven't thanked me, so you may not supplicate. Or if you're not good enough yet to use that one, you can use the teaspoon prayer, thank you, sorry, please. He doesn't say any of that. There's no formula. He just says, ask away. What do you want me to do for you? He says. And they reply with what they want. And, you know, he has every right to say, you've got this wrong, James and John, but he doesn't put them down or say, start again. He's available and accessible. Their request, though, is well off the mark. Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory. So he's just told them he's going to die and then rise again. They, being James and John, absolutely believe him. There's no doubt in their minds that's going to happen. So they say, they're thinking, wait a minute. If he rises again, he'll be a king. And if he's a king, there'll be top jobs available to help rule this kingdom, which is probably going to be the whole world. So let's get in there now and book a space and bag see the top jobs. So, and then when we see the same incident in Matthew, their mother comes with them, and it's not quite clear whether they persuaded their mother to ask for them or whether the mother persuaded them that this was a good idea to get these jobs, but certainly they've thought it through. And Jesus responds to them that they don't know what they're asking. He's very gentle in telling them, no, you've got it wrong. It was fine for you to ask. I welcome you asking for anything. But if you get it wrong, if you're asking for something that is not part of my story, if it's not leading you further into God's big story, then I'm going to teach you. And that's what he does here. He teaches them that his story is one of suffering and serving, being the least, being selfless, always putting others first. It's an upside-down kingdom compared to the world. He warns them about the cup he will drink, the enormous experience of suffering he's going to go through in this baptism, this overwhelming, life-changing experience. And he says to them, when they say, we can do it, he says, you will drink this cup and be baptized with this baptism. And maybe he's thinking, maybe he's knowing at that point that James is going to be the first disciple to be martyred. They will suffer. These are the sort of the good times compared to what is going to come for these disciples. But he says, to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. Asking for glory and power in God's kingdom shows that you are not in his story. You're in your own story where something else is important, where your own self-improvement is what's important. I wonder as well if Jesus, when he says this, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant, I wonder if he's got in mind the cross, where on Golgotha there'll be three crosses, Jesus in the middle, and there'll be someone on his right and someone on his left, because then he really will be in his glory, as James and John put it. There's no other point where Jesus is more showing God's glory than when he is dying on that cross. It's a very different right and left compared to what James and John are thinking, more like Prime Minister and Secretary of State. And it's worth noticing here that this is all taking place in community. So the disciples are together. There's the request from James and John. The others are looking on and they see it, and then they react negatively. They're indignant in verse 41, because they're thinking, oh, I was going to ask for that job. Or maybe they're thinking, hang on a minute, I didn't think of that. If I'd thought of that, I would have got there first. So now I feel bad that Jesus has kind of told them off, when actually I probably would have reacted exactly the same way. So now I'm going to take it out on James and John to show that I was never going to be like that, because I actually was. And community is what makes all this possible. So then Jesus then could teach them again. So he calls them together, verse 42, and teaches them this next bit about being selfless, not being like the Gentiles who lord it over their subjects, who make the most of the power and authority that they have, which is human nature, isn't it? When we have power, we use it. A famous quote that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's just a truth. And Jesus says, no, that's not the way I want you to be. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. It's about being last, it's about putting others first, to the point where it hurts, to the point where it inconveniences you greatly and perhaps constantly, that's the story that Jesus is calling them into. And this teaching point happens in community. So, you know, if they hadn't been living together like this, if this had all been a kind of private, individual cases, then the bigger teaching point wouldn't have arisen. The error of thinking that they were in was shown up by the disciples' error of thinking was shown up by the way they reacted to James and John, our reactions to each other, and then how we process that and work through that and hear from God and on that is how we grow and mature. So, I mean, one practical outworking of this is join a community group. If you're at Cornerstone, get committed to a community group, because this is the way Jesus set things up. He taught his disciples in community. I mean, they lived together 24/7. We only meet once a week. It's a brilliant way to, even through the negatives, even through the inconveniences, learn together and grow together and mature together, just as these disciples are doing, and get through all the awkwardness and inconvenience and come out the other side more like Jesus, deeper into his story. Okay, so this was their prayer. A bit of a messed up prayer, but Jesus welcomed it and taught them to draw them deeper into his story and point out to them that they are in their own story instead of his. And then we see a very different incident, another prayer with blind Bartimaeus. It's a contrast. So then they came to Jericho, and as Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, which means son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. There's some thought that son of Timaeus being pointed out like this might mean that he was the son of a blind man. His blindness might have been congenital. He maybe didn't even have eyes, which makes his healing all the more spectacular and noteworthy. It doesn't really make any difference. He's blind. And he's begging because in that society there is nothing more he can do. He has no way of earning a living, no way to make a life for himself except to beg for just sheer survival. And what does he hear? When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." So he hears Jesus, common name of Nazareth. Probably there was many Jesuses in Nazareth, but he knows who this is. He knows this is the famous Jesus of Nazareth who has been doing these miracles and teaching this way, and he has drawn his own conclusion that this Jesus is the Messiah, the one who was promised throughout all the past ages that we see recorded in the Old Testament. And he knows what was promised, because in Isaiah 35:5, it's promised that the Messiah would open the eyes of the blind. And Bartimaeus knows that, and he believes that that is for him, that that's a promise he can claim. And so he uses the messianic title, Son of David, the one that Jesus uses of himself, and says, "Have mercy on me." Now, at this point, people rebuke him, and it's likely that many of these people were there in chapter 10, verses 13 to 16, when the little children were being brought to Jesus and the disciples turned them away. Both beggars and children would have been on the fringes of this society. And they should have learned by now that Jesus doesn't see people on the fringes as on the fringes. These people tell the man to be quiet, just as the disciples tried to turn the children away, because they want to keep those people on the fringes. Jesus doesn't. So many rebuked Bartimaeus and told him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped. He stops the whole parade and says, "Call him." Because Bartimaeus is important. He matters. It doesn't matter that he's on the fringes. That is not Jesus' story. People on the fringes matter. The least are the greatest. And these people who wanted to kind of maintain their own position by pushing Bartimaeus down, they're the ones very much in the wrong. They're in their own story where keeping their own position is part of what defines them. And Jesus says, no, we're stopping, and we're calling Bartimaeus. And then there's this lovely moment in verse 49 where they change their tune and say, they call to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you, cheer up." I mean, how often do we use the word, you know, say cheer up, meaning how bad can it be, you know, just cheer up, meaning really I don't like your negative emotions, they're disturbing me and making me feel awkward, so can you please cheer up? But here, in terms of cheer up meaning, you know, be of good cheer, there could be no greater cause for good cheer than the fact that Jesus is calling you, that the Son of God with the power to do whatever you ask is calling you to come and ask. And that's exactly the position that we are in. No matter how bleak life gets, he is calling us. So we can always say, be of good cheer, cheer up. It's lovely that that's in there. And they say, on your feet, he's calling you. So Bartimaeus throws his cloak aside. Now, his cloak was probably his only worldly possession, an essential for surviving. You needed it to wrap you up at night, otherwise you'd freeze. You needed it to keep the sun off. It was your only possession if you were a beggar, most likely. But he throws it aside. He wants nothing to get in the way of getting to Jesus. He jumps to his feet, even though he's blind, can't see what's around him, and comes to Jesus. And then Jesus uses exactly the same words that he used for James and John in verse 51. What do you want me to do for you? Jesus asked him. And the blind man said, Rabbi, I want. Now, Rabbi is the same as teacher, just exactly the same as what James and John said. They said, teacher, we want. He says, teacher, I want to see. Now, because of what happens next, we know that he doesn't just want to see because he wants a better life. He wants to see because he wants Jesus, and we'll see that here. He wants to be part of this big story. He wants deeper into it, and his lack of sight is holding him back. He wants to be part of the messianic prophecy by receiving the healing that was prophesied, blind being made to see again. And he needs this sight to follow Jesus. Now, Jesus says, go, said Jesus. Your faith has healed you. It's in a way a bit modest of Jesus to say his faith has healed him, because Jesus has healed him. The man couldn't have healed himself by any amount of faith on his own. But his faith in Jesus, his wanting into this story, has unlocked the healing that Jesus has given him. And Jesus says, go. It's really important that Jesus says, go. He's saying, you're now free from this blindness that's holding you back, that means you can't build a life for yourself, and now you're free to go. It's an unconditional healing, no strings attached. If you want to now, Bartimaeus, you may go and, you know, earn money, start a family, become a pillar of your community, have a really good life, and probably dine out on the story of getting your sight back for the rest of your life. Bartimaeus can now go and have anything he wants, by contrast to what he had before. And Jesus sets him free to go. But does he go? Immediately, he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. It immediately almost sounds like he didn't even go back for his cloak. He's just wild abandon to following Jesus. And that shows that in this prayer, he was shouting for Jesus. He wanted to ask him for something. But what he wanted really was Jesus himself, not just what Jesus could get him. He wanted Jesus himself. Bartimaeus found his place in God's big story. So did James and John eventually, but only by learning from Jesus in community with others to show up where they were living in their own story instead. So we come back to the question, what story are you in? What story am I in? Not just right this minute, but again tomorrow and again the next day. Jesus is inviting us to come into this story, this grand story. He's inviting us to come to himself, to the true King who loves us, to come to him with whatever we want, wherever we are, to follow him as he leads us on into the one story that makes sense of all the others. And we can live in that story right now by turning away from the stories that we're in to live instead in the topsy-turvy kingdom, where we serve and love each other selflessly in community, learning together to grow more and more into this true story. And when we do, we'll see more of this story, which is building up to the happiest, most satisfying ending that there has ever been. It's an ending which is really the beginning of what will be the best story ever told. Let's pray. Father God, we thank you for your word, where you've given us these treasures to see how everything you did when you were here, Jesus, you did to teach us and to draw us into your big story. Thank you that in all that we do every day, we can be drawn deeper into that story. And we pray, Lord, that you would do that. Lead us on, Jesus. Show us how to live more selflessly, how to put others first, how to bear with one another, how to love one another, to go deeper and deeper into your story of redemption in this world. And we thank you that we have your great happy ending to look forward to, where you will wipe away every tear from our eye, where there will be no more death or mourning or sadness or crying or pain, because the old order of things will have passed away and you will make all things new. We thank you for that, and we give you the glory and ask that you would help us as we go into this week to live in your story. Amen.